Theater of the Mind. The Trans World Haunt and Attractions Trade Show this year was, as usual, an awesome time. Chris Baker couldn't come this year, which was unfortunate, but Johnny Thunder and I still had a great time and didn't have to worry about getting kicked out of any restaurants for anything vomit-related. Our good friends, the brothers Dolashal, were there with the amazing Mystery Bottomless backpack of beers, and it was great to see Rob and Stacy from Necrotic Creations again after last year's hiatus. I chatted with a few vendors I've come to know, and the word was pretty unanimous that sales were back up after the past few years' slump. Good times aplenty, and the weekend was over much too soon. I had a chance there to chat briefly with Ed Terribas, head honcho of the Erebus Haunted Attraction in Pontiac, Michigan, who had graciously given me a lights-on backstage tour of the haunt several years ago. I've talked about Erebus before in previous segments and marveled about how it's basically a pro haunt with a home haunter's approach. It's one of the few large-scale pro haunts where they make their own props. They take great pride in their creations and can rest assured that people will not go through noticing and identifying multiple props that they've already seen in other haunts. And there's just that great feeling that comes from the creative process, starting with an idea and seeing it gradually take shape and come to life. Home haunters do buy cool props, either because the artistry is out of their creative league or because they just don't have the time to put into building something. Unfortunately, some of us do have things like jobs we must go to, but I don't think I'm being presumptuous to think that if we had the unlimited time available, most of us would like to build the majority of our sets and props from scratch. This whole haunting thing, this madness we gleefully succumb to, is born out of love for expression through the creative process. And admit it, sometimes you just fall in love with something that you're building. You find yourself investing far more care and time into it than is necessary, lovingly detailing and refining it far beyond the point that any observer would notice at all. I think of this as the Pygmalion effect. If you're not familiar with the story, Pygmalion was a character in Greek mythology, a sculptor on the Isle of Cyprus, who was a disciple of Aphrodite, the goddess of love. He sought to make the ultimate statue of the goddess, so after making 100 or so test pieces from clay, he secured a block of the finest marble and went to work. He toiled day and night endlessly, and as the figure took form, he lovingly imbued it with the finest detailing of any statue he'd ever made, and this indescribably beautiful woman taking shape became the center of his universe. He named her Galatea, and gradually fell in love with her, and despaired knowing that she, being made of marble, could never return his love. When the festival day of Aphrodite came around, Pygmalion made his dedication and prayed to the goddess that if he could not find a bride who was as beautiful as his creation, he wanted to kiss Galatea and be turned to marble as well, so the two would be forever locked in eternal embrace. Aphrodite was deeply moved by the intensity of his affection, but, as the goddess of love, was a little more down with the passion of the warmer human variety, so when Pygmalion embraced his beloved Galatea, he felt her warm up and soften and become a real flesh-and-blood woman in his arms. The goddess herself officiated over their wedding, and the happy couple settled down and had a daughter and lived happily ever after, which is really quite an accomplishment in both Roman and Greek mythology, which is usually chock-full of tragedy and despair and horrible death. If he'd been able to break the fourth wall like Deadpool and see how much better he had it than all the characters in those other stories, he'd have been able to appreciate how truly lucky they really were. The idea of a man-made creation coming to life is an ancient concept existing in the mythologies and folklore of countless societies in human history. Many, however, are not always as happy as the tale of Pygmalion and Galatea, and often have tragic results. In Hebrew folklore, for example, we find stories of the golem, humanoid slaves created by rabbis who follow the path of the Kabbalah, a branch of Jewish mysticism. The golem is formed of clay and given the breath of life, which, in the tales, is usually bound to it by a sacred inscription on its forehead or on a scroll inserted into its mouth or hung around its neck. The creature could be formed for the purpose of domestic duties or manual labor, or, in the most famous tale of the Golem of Prague, as a sort of military sentry bot to defend the community from anti-Semitic attacks. In that tale, as the imbued life force continued to take hold on the once stupid and obedient creature, it gradually grew in strength and self-awareness, eventually becoming unstable and violent, threatening and attacking the very people it was charged to protect. Fortunately, its creator was able to wrest the scroll with the sacred words of binding from the golem's mouth, breaking the bond that sealed the life force within the clay, and the creature collapsed into rubble. According to legend, the chunks were not scattered or destroyed, but moved to some hiding place where they lie in wait to be reformed and reanimated if the need should ever arise.
If some future Mystic ever does find the Golem and get it back online, let's hope it reboots back to its original programming and doesn't just pick up where it left off and go on a rampage, which, come to think of it, would actually make a hell of a movie if it hasn't been done yet. If you're thinking that that story of the Golem of Prague sounds a lot like a certain famous book by Mary Shelley, an eventual iconic Universal Pictures movie monster, you're not alone. While there's no evidence that Shelley was influenced by the Jewish legend of the Golem, rather, her influences are widely believed to be a combination of her father William Godwin's novels, the Roman poet Ovid's retelling of the Greek myths of Prometheus and Pygmalion, and elements of her own tragic past, it still echoes the morality play elements of the dangers of humans playing God. It could also be seen as a cautionary tale of the potentially tragic effects of social ostracism. Frankenstein's monster is as much of a tragic victim as it is villain, as it begins its new life as a sympathetic creature, hated and shunned by society until it sees its own reflection and realizes how truly hideous it is. At this point, it commits several murders of people it believes responsible for its sorry fate and turns on its creator, demanding Dr. Frankenstein create a bride for it so it will no longer be alone in the world, and threatening to kill everyone he knows and loves until it gets its wish. Haunters and horror fans have a bounty of monsters to choose from. Demons, ghosts, shapeshifters, vampires, the undead. But I've always felt there should be a special category for those creatures I like to call the created. Why? Because they carry a layer of complexity, a subplot, if you will, that adds an extra storyline that can function as either an embellishment or the primary plot. The story of the creator. Why did the creator make the creature? What purpose was it made for? Good or evil? And, if said beasties are numerous, are they functioning independently or are they coordinated with a shared purpose? And are they still under the Maker's control? As is the case with many elements of a haunt's backstory, the tale of the creature's creation may be difficult to put across to the guests without presenting some narration. If the haunter opts to go this route, it's best that the line actor or host condense a very quick, simplified version of the story to the groups before they go through the haunt. It's fine to include extra story details on a plaque or sign, or extra bits of narration or hints dropped by a talking prop, but you should always assume that no one's going to read or listen to that, and that these written or oral extras are simply an added value feature, like the so-called Easter eggs in movies, that may add to a haunt-goer's enjoyment but is not critical to their understanding and enjoyment of the haunt. Hopefully, your scenes, scares, and actors are good enough that people will be entertained whether they really know the backstory or not. As to whether the creations are independent or working together for a common malign purpose, there are ways to suggest coordination even if people haven't been clued into it ahead of time. For example, they enter a doll room, and several dolls move to menace and attack the guests. Okay, that's scary and creepy, but are they working together or are they all just vicious and possessed, each one acting out its own malice? Now, picture it this way. A doll turns its head to look at the guests, then turns its head to look at another doll, which turns its head to make eye contact with the first. Then they both look toward a third doll, which swivels its head to look at both the first and second doll, and then all three of them move their heads in unison to look directly back at the guests. The whole sequence may take 4 or 5 seconds, but it definitely grabs attention, and it speaks volumes about what's going on. They're all working together, and they're all focused on you. A lot of people will be sufficiently freaked out by this simple body language that they won't even need any overtly threatening moves by the dolls to be thoroughly scared by it. Of course, if the dolls all raise knives at this point, it should pretty much seal the deal even for the slowest observer. Coordinated motion suggests coordinated purpose, and props or actors who move in unison toward the guests give an immediately understood sense that the baddies are an organized team with the goal of giving the outsiders a really bad day. The idea of a house full of creatures all created and controlled by a central villain can make for an oppressive, claustrophobic atmosphere because it suggests to the hauntgoers that they've been swallowed and they're in the proverbial belly of the beast, surrounded and trapped by the organs and agents of a single malignant purpose. In this type of storyline, lighting and sound effects or music that would work really well would be dark and foreboding, building a slow burn of tension. However, what if one of the first mangled dead bodies the audience sees is that of the creator? If they've been provided with a visual of the mad doctor or wizard or whoever at the beginning and see that he or she has been obviously killed by the created, then the idea becomes instantly clear. The created have gone completely off the rails, and there's no one controlling them. Under that scenario, a much more chaotic and deranged atmosphere would work nicely, with layouts, lighting, and soundscapes that enhance the sense of craziness, confusion, and panic. The creatures, no longer under any control, may be faster and behave more randomly. Both scenarios work great. The haunter just needs to decide which atmosphere they want to work for, and then coordinate their visual and sound elements to fit the right atmosphere to that storyline. While the idea of created beings initially brings to mind images of evil dolls, puppets, robots, cyborgs, and voodoo zombies, not all malign creations need to fall into the anthropomorphic category. Many good horror movies and books have been made about outbreaks of other artificial life forms via genetic tampering, mutation, or mechanical self-replication. A containment failure in a bioresearch lab, for example, could result in the facility being overrun with hideous plant and fungal growth, consuming or infecting everyone in contact with it and spreading out of control. These scenarios tap into a fairly recent but widely understood fear of what happens when an alien species is introduced into a new environment with no known controls for it. Ask a southerner about kudzu or Spanish moss. Ask any fisherman what happens if Asian carp, rock snot, or zebra mussels get introduced into a waterway. It's a disaster that's almost impossible to reverse. Now, apply that to a plotline involving an out-of-control bioweapon, a nanotech project, or genetically modified organism, and just go to town with it. Here, we tap into the Lovecraftian endgame of the search for knowledge going too far, and the hapless researchers reaping the nightmare harvest of terrible truths that were better left alone. Alexander Pope wrote long ago that a little learning is a dangerous thing, but 200 years later, Lovecraft let us know that too much learning can be an absolute disaster. Movies from the silence of the 20s to the blockbusters of today have plumbed the dark shadows and darker results of such pursuits taken beyond the limits of ethical responsibility and human control. Ancient mythologies, folklores, and sci-fi and horror literature dating from Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, A Modern Prometheus, to the medical and science thrillers of Michael Crichton and Robin Cook all give us a glimpse of the horrors that can be unleashed when man steps beyond his boundaries and chooses to play creator with that most mysterious, awesome, and terrible force of all, life itself. The hazards of playing God with the very essence of life are more relevant now than ever before. With genetic engineering, artificial intelligence, and transhumanism no longer merely the stuff of weird fiction, but the topic of headlines and active research and development taking place even as we speak. Goblins, demons, and monsters of the underworld can be terrifying enough, but sometimes the most terrifying monsters of them all are not born. They are made, and they are made by us. So, haunters, what are you planning to make? Keep the ghost light burning. From the Theater of the Mind, I'm Revenant, and you're listening to Hauntcast.
I'm going now. Heaven help you.
Please like and follow the podcast. Stalk us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Links in the description. And help us by sharing Hauntcast with all your haunt and Halloween brethren. Until next time, stay scary.